to the Cadre School for this weekend. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Megan. I organize with the LaRouche Youth Movement out of the Boston, Massachusetts office. So Jenny and I came up for the weekend to be with you guys. I also just got back from participating for 5 months in the spearhead of Lyndon LaRouche's response to the current crisis that the world is facing right now, which is a project to master the scientific discoveries made by Johannes Kepler, who lived over 400 years ago. And he also discovered universal gravitation. So I participated in what LaRouche is calling Kepler 2, the Kepler 2 team, or the phase 2 of an ongoing project that's going to be going on for probably the next year or so, at least, in his basement. And just to kind of back up a little bit, and Michelle's going to get into this after I'm finished, a lot of the details, but many of you probably know or have a sense of the current crisis that the world is facing. You know, focusing on the United States, just what's immediately obvious is that you have a leadership in the United States which exhibits clinical insanity in the case of Bush. You have a vice president who's a complete sociopath and actually hates human beings and responds in that way. And you have a drive right now coming from the office of the U.S. vice president to start a nuclear war in the very near future, maybe the next couple weeks. So that's the immediate danger on the table, along with the financial crisis, which Michelle is going to get into. But barring that, even if that weren't the case, the world would still be facing a very profound crisis of the physical economy. And what I mean by that is that the planet currently has 6.5 billion people on it, 6.5 billion human beings living around the world. And human beings have, at least we share one particular characteristic, which is that we're not beasts. We're not just animals. So let me put it this way. Considering that fact that you have 6.5 billion people living on the planet, who all, in potential, exhibit characteristics of genius, much like Lyndon LaRouche or Ben Franklin, what our movement is fighting for is the idea that it's the right of every human being to actually live at the highest possible standard of living so that they can contribute something to the future of mankind. So the strategic challenge on the table right now for our generation, poised at this very unpredictable moment in history, is whether or not we can actually organize nation states around the world and organize the physical economic policies to support 6.5 and more billion people at the highest possible standard of living. And so that puts very practical questions on the table, questions of natural resources and the available natural resources, things like clean water, which there isn't enough of. So you have these questions coming up now. How do we manufacture enough clean water to make it available to everybody? And things like this. So LaRouche is looking to our generation to tackle these problems for the next 50 or so years, at least the next 50 years until we can train the next generation after us. So when you look at the kind of education that our generation received and the kind of culture and way of thinking that our generation received from the baby boomer generation, our parents, things aren't looking too good. Because unfortunately, most people in universities today don't know how to run an actual economy and don't know the difference between, they actually don't know that there's no economic value in things like money. So LaRouche formed a project within his youth movement where he has young people that are actually working through the discovery of Johannes Kepler and replicating his process of the discovery of a true physical principle, gravitation, which was phase one. And then moving on to his later work, The Harmony of the World, you have the replication of an idea of an organized, composed solar system. So I participated in that project, and I just wanted to show you briefly, we put out a pretty extensive website, which is a report on our work, which is available for anybody. It's available for people in the youth movement, people that are working with the youth movement, the United States Congress, to work through, and actually a guide to replicating the discovery of Johannes Kepler, which I'm actually going to get into in much, much more detail tomorrow night. But just to show you guys a little bit what we've done, each of these books are part of the book, The Harmony of the Worlds, of Kepler. The first of which is on geometry. We don't have the plug-in. It's okay, we can get it before tomorrow. But you have a book investigating planar geometry. You have a book investigating solid geometry, which are, you know, these sorts of things, the cube, the octahedron. You have a book investigating music. You have a book investigating philosophy and how the human mind actually comes to know principles and why the human mind can recognize a truthful principle. And then you have book 5, which is the aim of the entire writing, which is on astronomy and astrophysics and how you know that the universe was composed by a creator and how you know that the universe is harmonic and it's actually becoming more organized. That's kind of what I wanted to say for tonight, at least, to introduce and give you guys a sense of the cutting edge of what our youth movement is doing. But we're taking this work onto university campuses all over the United States. We're actually producing a DVD, I think, of a lot of the work and also the presentation that we recently gave, the team that I was with recently gave in Washington, D.C. We're taking this work into the United States Congress with a very large group of people. I think it's 30 people in Washington, right? We have 30 young people from around the United States and Washington, D.C. for the next 70 to 80 days who are going to be taking this kind of scientific challenge in the context of solving the world crisis into the United States Congress and educating the United States Congress in this work specifically. So,
yeah. This is already
switch again.
Yeah, I have to do that. Already, yeah.
Okay, well, Pascal does that, I'll say a few things about the Kyber School and about my presentation. As Megan said, I'm Michelle Steinberg. I'm from Leesburg, Virginia, where LaRouche's Political Action Committee, LaRouche PAC, is centered, and where we produce this magazine, Executive Intelligence Review. Also, a science magazine, 21st Century Science and Technology. And we run the political operations to put Dick Cheney in jail, and in the jailhouse, and George Bush in the nut house. And we're not kidding about that. What we accomplished in the year 2006 was a revolution in American politics, which is actually in Canadian politics, too, in world politics. And that was after 12 years, we've been able to get rid of what was called the conservative revolution. And the conservative revolution, philosophically, are fascists. And what Megan said about the Vice President of the United States plans to launch a war, and a nuclear war, possibly within the next couple of weeks, is the absolute truth. Most people go through their day, their week, their life without even thinking about this, or thinking, oh, it's a terrible thing, but it's nothing that I can do anything about. And we can do a lot about it. So this isn't a weekend where we're going to be planning demonstrations outside the White House. We do that every day. You know, we do that every day on the corner. We drive them crazy. Jenny and Megan come from Boston, which is the home of the art of the political canons, which are these songs, these musical compositions, satirical musical compositions about... you know, about the real Dick Cheney, for example, in Christmas time, there was one called Cheney's Wife with Whip Held High. Lynn Cheney is a dominatrix. You didn't know that, right? they devised the torture policy in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and so forth. And it's through this combination of really deadly political precision and humor that we can actually get this job done. Now, As far as I know, the program, the series of classes is really going to be tremendous. If you always wanted to know, is there such thing as a secret one world government, people who behind the scenes control the actions of governments, manipulate things, manipulate finance, and so forth. Well, there's a truth to that. There's also a lot of baloney behind it, that you get conspiracy theories on the internet and so forth, and you end up knowing nothing. But there is, you know, such a network of people who brought us Adolf Hitler, they brought us totalitarianism and so forth, and right now what they're trying to do is to destroy any government which actually represents its people. So that's a strategic crisis that we're in. And yesterday, Mr. LaRouche had a meeting in Washington, D.C., where he met a really large gathering of top-level representatives of 23 different countries. It included three ambassadors. They came from Africa, from Russia, from the Middle East, from Europe, from Asia, from South America, all over the place, because they are very, very concerned that the United States has set a deadline for February 11th, which if Iran does not stop its nuclear research, then there could be another war like the war that started in March 2003 against Iraq. Now, the 11th, if I'm not wrong, is 2 days from now.
That's a deadline for what?
For Iran to cease its nuclear research. So that's what they're being told by Cheney and company.
So aside from North Korea and with the nuclear stuff, that Iran is in it too.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a dangerous world. It's a very dangerous world, and we've got leaders who want to take advantage of that situation, not to bring about peace, but to bring about more wars. And I want to go through the current situation behind this, and tell you how we're going to get to the future successfully without getting blown up into another world war. And look, the United States has been in a war now in Iraq for 4 years. 3,000 American soldiers have died. The bulk of them are between 19 and 25 years old, just about the same as most of the people here. And they're talking about, you know, another war, and there's members of Congress saying, you better institute a draft where the children of the rich as well as the children of the poor are going to have to go and, you know, and fight in these wars. So, you know, this is like the Vietnam era that you read about or heard about or saw in the movies and so forth, happening again. And so there's a role that critical role that the LaRouche youth movement plays in this, because up until November the 6th of last year, the party that controls the White House also controlled the United States House of Representatives, also controlled the United States Senate, also controlled the Supreme Court. So all of the checks and balances that were in the Constitution of the United States were all tilted in one direction. So there was nothing institutionally outside us being able to mobilize the population themselves that could actually stop these dictators from proceeding ahead with what they were doing. So we went to the people, and the critical vote, because some of these elections were really close. They were within like 200 votes or 1,000 votes, the difference between whether a Democrat, which is the party that LaRouche is in, that we're in the United States, or a Republican, which has become the Bush War Party, the difference sometimes was like a couple of hundred votes. And the way we changed that was we did something completely unexpected, which all of the money in the world from the richest polling companies, newspapers, and so forth could not anticipate, was the vote of people from 18 to 25 years old. You know why? Because they had mostly never voted before. So there was no way to look at past trends and say the election's going to go this way. But how do you get young people inspired to vote? Right? I mean, you know, think about most of the conversations you have. Don't a lot of people say things like, you can't change the world? Right? It's not, you know, it's not my problem. You know, I've got this or that to do. So that is really what was cut through. And in the course of this weekend, we're going to discuss that. We're also going to discuss what's real economics, how a man by the name of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president of the United States during World War II, got North America out of a deep, deep depression. Val is going to give a presentation on the Round Table, the British Round Table, which is one of the secret societies going back 100 years. We are going to have a presentation on Plato's Academy, right? Pascal's going to do part of that. And we're also going to be discussing the situation in the Middle East, per se. Is it a war about oil? Is it a clash of civilizations? Is it something which cannot be solved? Are the Islamists the new fascism, as Bush and Cheney would say? The answer to that is no, but this is becoming, you know, a code word around the world, in Europe, right? There's a war inside France, inside Germany, inside Belgium and Holland to cast the Muslim population as the quote-unquote enemy. Round them up, throw them in Guantanamo, send them back to where they came from. In the United States, you're starting to have race war against the Mexicans and the, you know, the El Salvador illegal immigrants and so forth. So these secret societies which do exist are specializing in manipulating different parts of the population against one another at a time when the reality is that their financial banking system is coming down. That's the reality of it. Now, the best way to understand sometimes your own current history is to step back and look at a longer wave of history. And there's many details and data sets that can get very confusing because the Wall Street bankers, for example, when they want to sell stock to people, they're not going to tell you the system's going to collapse. They're going to tell you, you know, invest your money here, you're going to become a millionaire, you could retire by the time you're 35, all of this kind of stuff, you know, to keep the flow going. They tell you, buy a house, you know, the value of the house is going to double. And this is a real estate bubble, which is now in the process of collapsing. Thank you. Excuse me. But there's, thank goodness, Pascal's going to read something for us. But we're on the verge of a collapse of a system, which LaRouche has described as the as a collapse like the 14th century. How many of you have ever heard of the bubonic plague? Right, the Black Death, it was also called. How many of you know that there was a total collapse of the banking system in all of the civilized world in 1348? Okay, a few specialists who, you know, studied European history or something like that. Okay, well, that's what happened. In 1348, the leading banking centers were all based in Italy, a swampy kingdom called Venice, one of the worst dictatorships that ever was created. If you invite me back sometime, I'll tell you all about Venice, which It was really, really, really one of the most incredibly evil dictatorships that that ever existed. But they controlled all of banking. And the way they would control the world was they would manipulate different countries into wars. For example, the Crusades. God's war to take back the holy places from the infidels of Islam, etc. And they would lend money to the kings to
who would lend money to the kings?
The Venetian banks or the other Italian banks. And then they would take all the collateral, like the sheep that were the main source of income from the wool, etc. And at one point, one of the kings of England, King Edward, said, "That's it, I'm not paying anymore." And that set off a chain reaction where a number of these banks collapsed in 1348. And this absolutely created a collapse of society. It happened to coincide with a catastrophe, a disease catastrophe. And that was the onset of this plague. And then in the next few months and the year after this catastrophe, in the next 3 years or so, three quarters of the population died in different parts of Europe, especially Italy. Now, I mean, just imagine that kind of disease. Imagine if, you know, the AIDS epidemic, the way it is in Africa or in South Africa today, they have a kind of tuberculosis, which is drug resistant. You can't, you know, you can't stop the infection from one person to the other. And this is so virulent that a few weeks ago, out of 55 people who got the TB, 52 of them were dead within like a month. Right, so diseases are like that around the planet. Imagine if we didn't have public health and we didn't have medications and, you know, we didn't have the means of arresting these type of epidemics, what kind of shape we'd be in. So between the financial collapse, the disease vectors, and then this perpetual war that's being forced by the U.S. government, which is one of the most powerful in the world, if not the most powerful, you really have the makings of a dark age. But to really understand that, I want to go back in history to that point of 1348, where in the city of Florence, Italy, which was really one of the richest trade centers, education centers, and so forth, they had such a catastrophe. And an Italian author by the name of Giovanni Boccaccio wrote a book about this called The Decameron. And the introduction to that is something I asked Pascal to read so everybody gets a clear idea of that. If you want to say anything about it first, you can.
I don't really have an introduction to that. But, yeah, just for it, you'll see clearly what it means. The symptoms were not the same as in the East, where a gush of blood from the nose was the plain sign of inevitable death. But it began both in men and women, with certain swellings in the groin or under the armpit. They grew to the size of a small apple or an egg, more or less, and were vulgarly called tumors. In a short space of time, these tumors spread from the two parts named all over the body. Soon after this, the symptoms changed, and black or purple spots appeared on the arms or thighs, or any other part of the body, sometimes a few large ones, sometimes many little ones. These spots were a certain sign of death, just as the original tumor had been and still remained. No doctor's advice, no medicine could overcome or alleviate this disease. An enormous number of ignorant men and women set up as doctors, in addition to those who were trained. Either the disease was such that no treatment was possible, or the doctor were so ignorant that they did not know what caused it, and consequently, could not administer the proper remedy. In any case, very few recovered. Most people died within about 3 days of the appearance of the tumors described above, most of them without any fever or other symptoms. The violence of this disease was such that the sick communicated it to the healthy who came near them, just as a fire catches anything dry or oily near it. And it even went further. To speak to or go near the sick brought infection and a common death to the living. And moreover, to touch the clothes or anything else the sick had touched or worn gave the disease to the person touching. Okay, now varying reaction to disasters. Such fear and fanciful notions took possession of the living that almost all of them adopted the same cruel policy, which was entirely to avoid the sick and everything belonging to them. By doing so, each one thought he would secure his own safety. The plight of the lower and most of the middle classes was even more pitiful to behold. Most of them remained in their houses, either through poverty or in hopes of safety, and fell sick by thousands. Since they received no care and attention, almost all of them died. Many ended their lives in the streets, both at night and during the day. And many others who died in their houses were only known to be dead because the neighbors smelled their decaying bodies. Dead bodies filled every corner. Most of them were treated in the same manner by the survivors, who were more concerned to get rid of their rotting bodies than moved by charity towards the dead. With the aid of porters, if they could get them, they carried the bodies out of the houses and laid them at the door, where every morning quantities of the dead might be seen. They then were laid on biers, or, as these were often lacking, on tables. It was come to this that a dead man was then of no more account than a dead goat would be today.
I wanted to use that quote. Boccaccio is really one of the great humanist thinkers. But I was struck by especially what Megan said, that there's one characteristic that all human beings have, no matter what country we're from, which is that we're not beasts. But you could see in a breakdown like this, which happened in 1348, that what Boccaccio observed was exactly that people became as beasts. Especially it came down to this, that the death of a man became of no more consequences than a dead goat is today. And you know, you see that kind of disconnect around the world when it comes to policy. People, you know, talk about world hunger, give to world hunger, human rights, and so forth, and yet nothing changes in terms of the economy. So So I want to tell you, first of all, who is Lyndon LaRouche, a bit about that, and then what he has done in the past and what we're doing today to absolutely ensure that this nuclear war doesn't happen. All right? So LaRouche is an 84-year-old American. He's run as a presidential candidate. He is a leader in the Democratic Party. And he's really a, you know, a genius, an intellectual genius in a number of very, very specific fields. Science, physics are one of them. He's trained as a physical economist. Now, that's different than, you know, a stockbroker or something like that. What's the physical economy? It is the science of running nations for the general welfare of the people, to feed, clothe, educate populations, and to bring about the next generation, hopefully at a higher intellectual and more leisure time level than their previous generation. Right? Not for the purpose of you know, just taking care of physical needs, but bringing about the great cultural contributions that make us use our minds and bring us closer to the higher purpose of human beings. I have a major water experiment going on there. Leonardo da Vinci must be here. No, so these are LaRouche's politics. And he turns to some of the great thinkers of the past. Yeah, I'll be there in a minute. Okay. Let me get to it. To
it's not open right now.
For both our inspiration and how are we going to okay.
Yeah.
You know, how are we going to get through these crises? This is a picture of the School of Athens, but it was painted in it was painted in the 15th century, in the 1400s. It's in the Vatican, and was painted by Raffaello, the Italian artist. And here we have Plato, Aristotle. It's hard to see everywhere, but here you have Socrates, one of his students, Alcibiades. You have Xenophon. You have all of the classical figures from the time of Athens. And it's interesting, why would you see a bunch of pagans like that in the study of the Roman Catholic Pope? These were all, you know, most of the figures in this were 400 before Christ. So there was no Christianity, and they worshipped Zeus and you know, Apollo and Mars and all of these pagan gods and so forth. So what's going on here? The great minds of the Renaissance, this was during the Italian Renaissance, 100 years after what Pascal just read to you. So you went from this really horrible situation where people hated each other so much because of the economic breakdown and the disease, where they could actually come about to create a Renaissance of painting, art. They built the most fantastic cathedrals. People like Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, Michelangelo, up in Germany, he had incredible Albrecht Dürer doing his work on perspective and so forth going on at that same time. In that period of 100 years, something really happened. Out of the Dark Age, out of the necessity of the Dark Age to do something, you actually had a meeting that took place. It was called the Council of Florence. The same Florence which was described in the Dark Ages. And all of the Christians of the world got together at that point and basically said, we've got to do something to save humanity. And they started with an idea that man is in the image of God. That there is a creator, there is a lawfulness to the universe, there is a harmony to the universe. It's not arbitrary, it's not evil, we're not born to suffer, and that we live for a higher purpose. And that's what the Renaissance was about, and it's reflected in its art, etc. And then in the next 100 years, approximately, you had the developments in science, which by the end of the 16th century, you have Johannes Kepler, who Megan was just talking about, that the LIM have studied for the last year, the man who proved that there is a harmony in the universe and that man's mind could know it. So that's one vision of humanity. That's the one that we want to fight for. And then the other one is the strategic danger of nuclear war. So I'm going to need the lights back on so I could read from some things. And that's what I'm going to really concentrate the rest of the presentation on, is the current strategic crisis, and that there is a science to prevent nuclear destruction. And it's a defense system that Lyndon LaRouche designed in the late 1970s, which was adopted by President Ronald Reagan in the United States. He was the president from 1980 to 1988. A lot of you weren't born yet. And unfortunately, his plan never got implemented because of sabotage by some of his own people, including the father of the current president of the United States, who was his vice president. Now, why is this important? Why is what happened in 1982-83 important now? Well, something happened on January 11th, which you might not know about, which actually changed history. And that was the news that the Chinese government deployed a weapon which destroyed a high-altitude satellite, its own satellite, while it was in orbit. And there was a lot of speculation because the Chinese did it, but they didn't put out a press release and say, we'd like to announce that we now have the capability to shoot down any American, NATO, or other satellites that are spying on us. Right? They just did it, and there's been a lot of speculation. And there's now there's a drive from the United States accusing China of trying to militarize space and therefore cause World War III.
What does that mean?
To put weapons in space, to turn space in the heavens into a battlefield. Mm-hmm. Right? Which in fact is going on. And it's quite a dangerous situation. But you could either use space for a defensive system until we actually can get rid of nuclear weapons. But in order to get rid of nuclear weapons, you better make the world a more stable place. And this gets back to the Iran crisis. Right? 4 years ago, President Bush gave a speech and said, because of 9/11, we are going to stop the axis of evil from threatening the planet. And he named Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. None of those countries had a darn thing to do with 9/11. None of them. But he was using the opportunity because he was the representative puppet of a faction that wanted to use the 9/11 incident as a means to create a world dictatorship. So he used the opportunity of his yearly speech to the Congress to say, we are declaring war on the axis of evil. 1 year later, without any reason at all, he launched the invasion of Iraq. And then since then, the threats against North Korea and Iran have continued. Now, in point of fact, it is by international agreement from 1968, it's called the Non-Proliferation Treaty, every country in the world has the right to develop nuclear power, including their own fuel cycle. That's the treaty that the United States wrote, and that's the treaty that was signed by 181 countries. Every country has the right to turn uranium into fuel, because by doing this you can have nuclear power reactors that can, you know, desalinate salt water, you can power your cities, you can have extremely cheap electricity. But what this crowd that put Bush in power, and this is the same crowd that has, in fact, a dictatorship over Canada. It's called the British oligarchy, the Anglo-Dutch oligarchy. And in the course of the next couple of days, Rob, who's going to be giving a presentation, or others, can tell you about the Queen of England's intervention into Canada to tell Canadian wheat and grain growers how much they are allowed to charge for their crop. You didn't know the Queen might take care of such little tiny details as that, right? This is going to bankrupt the food producers of Canada, and it's already going on in the United States of North America. So the idea of the Anglo-Dutch oligarchy is world empire, and it was a long process of destruction of the United States to get us to the point where they could install a government in the White House that was a complete puppet of this. I won't go into the details, but you can ask me a question later. You have to remember, of course, that Bush was not elected either time for president. The first time, in Florida, he was not elected. He was ordered to be president by a judge in the Supreme Court. So it was a coup d'etat, and in order to consolidate it, once the 9/11 occurred, they went into this preemptive war, axis of evil mode, playing on the emotions of people and the fears of people to say, now to stop terrorism, we must have the power to launch preemptive war. Before that time, ever since the United Nations was created, actually, the idea of starting a war, if you had not been directly attacked by that country, was a criminal act under international law. You follow me, right? So if you weren't directly attacked by that power, the mere fact that you attacked them unprovoked would make you an international criminal. That's the treaty that went into effect after Hitler, after World War II, that the U.S. Assigned and so forth. So many people have said the United States is engaging in criminal action, but who's gonna enforce it? Who has the power to enforce it? Only the people of the United States, by changing the government, unless you want to risk more wars or something like that. So that's the paradox that we're in. That's what we have been. That's what we've been working on changing. So when the Chinese conducted this satellite test, what they were reacting to actually was a series of provocation. What were they doing? They know darn well that the U.S. has set this deadline on Iran, They know that the U.S. is going to act whether or not the United Nations wants them to. And it is the fact that inside the United States, it is also understood that the only really way to stop this is not by act of Congress saying, let's have dialogue with Iran, etc., but to move for the impeachment of this government. The impeachment means the removal under the Constitution by investigation and trial of the president and the vice president. But we have to get rid of the vice president first. Because if you remove the president at this point, the next in succession is Dick Cheney, right? So you get a sociopath who will not hesitate the least from... he has no countervailing influences on him. So the Chinese were reacting to the Iran war drive. They're also reacting to the way Bush, on January the 10th, made a speech to announce a escalation in Iraq. Many people thought that after this famous commission called the Baker-Hamilton Commission had come out with a report saying the real way to get out of the Iraq quagmire, the Iraq war, is to go for peace between the Israeli and the Arabs in general, not just the Palestinians. But in point of fact, every Arab nation surrounding Israel, except for Jordan and Egypt, only two, every other country surrounding Israel is technically still in a state of war against Israel. And Israel is in a state of war against them. Because the 1967 war never ended in an actual peace agreement. It only ended in a ceasefire. So when you see the Middle East flare up, you know, constantly, and, you know, you're told, oh, this has been going on for years. It has been going on for years. But it's going on for years because specifically, you know, by design, and at various points, certain factions in the United States have bailed out the Israeli government. To the tune of really tens of billions of dollars, even at the point like in 1973, the Egyptian military was actually making significant gains over the Israelis. And Henry Kissinger stepped in and really sent them everything that they needed in terms of material. So, the Baker-Hamilton Commission said, look, the first thing you got to do is the Arabs and the Israelis must come to peace. Secondly, you can't solve Iraq all by itself. It's a bad neighborhood. You know, it's a tough neighborhood. We have to have a whole regional agreement among the countries, which means the whole region of the Gulf, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, they have to go into economic cooperation and stabilize the whole area. The more destitute people are, the poorer they are, the more likely they are to continue to kill each other. And now you have this sectarian religious war, which is like another bad chapter of European history, almost as bad as the Dark Age of the bubonic plague time, which was called the 30 Years' War. It was a religious war. It's been deliberately sparked. And the Baker-Hamilton Commission came up with 79 recommendations that had to be taken to stop the fighting and so forth. Many of these recommendations were exactly what LaRouche wrote about in 2004. And we can, I plan to go into that in detail, you know, during one of the sessions that we have later on in the weekend. I mean, just simple things. simple things like having in Iraq a program of jobs, of education, of providing water projects. Iraq may be may have a lot of desert, but it also has the two major rivers in the Middle East, the Tigris and the Euphrates. Iraq can be a breadbasket for itself and all the surrounding areas and even into Africa and so forth. So those kind of visions can be implemented and you get beyond the tragedy. What did Bush say? We're not talking to Syria and Iran. They know what they got to do. So, he's stuck absolutely in this mentality that the only way you deal with weaker countries is to show them who's boss. And if they didn't get the message, send in 50,000 more troops. So this has caused a complete revolt, and the rest of the world is looking at this and saying, this nation is on a track which is going to lead to global war. Because right now, the Iraq war has so sapped the military and economic strength of the United States that the only way they could actually conduct a war against Iran, I mean, to give you an example, Iraq had 25 million people, and we're stuck there now for going on the fifth year. We're just finishing the fourth full year of occupation. Iran, next door, has, I think it's 70 million people. And a military which is all the much larger, plus an air force, plus a missile force, ballistic missiles that can go hundreds of miles and so forth. So what Dick Cheney's war plans actually have is we, if necessarily, will use nuclear bombs to take out Iran's research sites where they're conducting these nuclear experiments. And every time you hear the term, all options are on the table, find the nearest fallout shelter. Because all options are on the table, are their clever lying way to not say, yes, we will be the first country since the end of World War II to use nuclear weapons.
The only country.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because we were the first in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the only country. Now, LaRouche said what the Chinese have done, see, we're not criticizing the Chinese and saying, oh my God, they're starting World War III by shooting down the satellites. What Linda LaRouche is saying is they are reacting in the only sane, predictable way that you would expect them to react when they see what the United States is doing in terms of the long-term U.S. policy. Because the real aim of this Anglo-Dutch Washington gang is war against Russia and China. Right? There's a faction in the United States, the same people who are trying to take over the Middle East resources, that said, well, we defeated the Soviet Union. And they're not at all happy that Russia has sort of come back to become economically on its feet again. And they're not at all happy that China, while it's the major producer for the United States of everything, everything from clothing to electronics to all kinds of cheap garbage that is produced at slave labor wages, even though China is one of the main trade partners, the fact is, this oligarchy does not want this 1.2 billion people to become an economic superpower. So this imperial crowd, the Anglo-Dutch U.S. Crowd, is actually similarly preparing for the time that China could become the superpower that challenges U.S. sole superiority. So the Chinese also know that that is up in the future. And they also reacted to a new space doctrine that came out. It's called the U.S. National Space Policy, and it was only made public in October of this year, just, you know, 2 months before they, or 3 months before they did their satellite demonstration, showing we can shoot down something that's orbiting 500 miles above the Earth. That's pretty good accuracy. But what they were aware of is that this new space doctrine came out. The last time there was a space doctrine was 1996. So this was 10 years later. And it's really another Cheney special, because it says, the United States will seek to cooperate with other nations in the peaceful use of outer space and use the benefits of space to protect and promote freedom around the world. The United States considers space systems to have the rights of passage without interference. The United States will view purposeful interference with its space systems as an infringement of its rights. The United States considers space capabilities, including the ground and space supporting links, vital to its national interests. Consistent with this policy, the U.S. will preserve its rights, capabilities, and freedom of action in space, and dissuade or deter others from either impeding those rights or developing the capabilities intended to do so. Right? We will deter anybody from developing those capabilities intended to interfere in the U.S. rights to do anything it wants in space in its national interest. So they don't even have to have the capabilities, but if they're trying to develop the capabilities which the U.S. considers a threat to its national interest, this document announces that the United States is going to do what they can to deter that operation. Now, what does that mean? They're going to take out a research facility? Are they going to impose an economic blockade? Are they going to act unilaterally? Any of those things that I mentioned are possible under the statements of this doctrine. So this is what the Chinese reacted to. They're kind of saying, we're not going to sit around and wait to see whether we're going to be attacked or not. We know that the United States is using space capabilities to prepare to attack China in the future. And we're going to work on the defense of our own nation. And what LaRouche is telling people is that the methodology and the technology that they're using is simply to understand that the new U.S. military doctrine is to attack everything from the air. You all heard the term shock and awe, remember that? Right, shock and awe was the air campaign launched against Iraq to actually absolutely smash, you know, everything that was standing in order to achieve a military victory within 3 weeks. And it worked. Right? They were flying 2,000 to 3,000 bombing raids a day.
What happened to the hearts and minds?
Yeah, right. Kick their butts and the hearts and minds will follow is, you know, sort of the slogan. It was shock and awe. Right, 3,000 bombing missions a day. And then Bush put on his little costume, dressed up like an airman, a an Air Force guy, Air Force pilot, and he went on a aircraft carrier and stood in front of a big sign that said mission accomplished, because we had succeeded in smashing a very, relatively strong, rich Middle East country and only lost 167 soldiers in the process. So, and then now it's 4 years after that, and another 3,000 soldiers have died after the mission was accomplished. So this concept, this doctrine of air power, overwhelming air force, which is the U.S. doctrine, includes space and that remote targeting. Now, I'm not a weapons specialist or so forth, so I'm repeating explanations that have been, given to me. But, everybody knows what GPS is, right? These little gadgets you put on your windshield and tells you where you are and, how to get to the next place and so forth. On a much more sophisticated basis, these are... this global positioning technology, which is all coded and secret codes and cryptology and so forth, are used to target missiles, intercontinental missiles or submarine missiles, because you just don't want to shoot these things off. They've got to land where you want them to land, in strategic places. You want to take out the enemy's missiles. You want to take out their air force and stuff like that. But all that depends on communication satellites that, tell the equipment and the technology and the computers where the target is. So what Lynn was explaining yesterday to the diplomats, what LaRouche was explaining, was the Chinese are developing systems using lasers and other things where No, they don't have to hit every missile that's coming in. Take out the satellite. Take out the guidance system. It's sitting there in space, it's orbiting, it's in a fixed position, and so forth. And if you screw up the, if you blind that process, which is not an easy thing, you need teams, hundreds and hundreds of scientists, working round the clock. You need really a good education system, etc. But they're looking at the future and they're saying, we've got to be prepared to defend ourselves. We know what direction the U.S. is headed. So we know what the future of warfare is. That's what the Chinese have done. And this has completely upset the apple cart, because the United States decided not to develop the system that the Chinese are working on, which LaRouche told them almost 30 years ago, that this was the future of warfare. So, now here we are in a situation right now where an enemy, or a future enemy, China is definitely not our enemy, quite the opposite. But a potential future enemy, adversary, is now equipped with the kind of weapon system which can defeat all our hundreds of trillions of dollars that have gone into weapons. Where does that put us on the global war on terrorism? Not in a very secure position. And what LaRouche has said about this is this means that the non-proliferation regime is over. Now, what's the non-proliferation regime? This is a complete hoax, dream, fraud, fantasy cooked up at a time when there were only 5 nuclear weapons powers in the world. Let me see if I can remember them at this point. The United States, Russia, United Kingdom, France, and China, right? As of 1968, those were the only 5 nuclear weapon acknowledged countries. right? So two of them were communist. And the irony is that all five of them had been allies in World War II. And they were all, and they're all the permanent members of the UN Security Council, who are supposed to be the countries which actually preserve the peace. Right? So Russia, the United States, Britain, France, and China. And they all agreed that none of them would give nuclear bombs to any other country. And however, if, and then all of the other, under this treaty, if the country signed it, the signers would also agree that they would not make any nuclear bombs. In return, the treaty says they would be allowed to develop nuclear energy as long as it wasn't bombs. Fair enough,
what
right?
What do you use nuclear energy for other than bombs?
Oh, it's one of the best, cleanest, cheapest, most plentiful energy resources.
I know you can use it to cure, cancer.
That's nuclear medicine. That's, mm-hmm. yeah, that's a different process. But, you know, these nuclear energy plants, the current generation can really, really accomplish, you know, massive amounts of energy, which, you know, even 50 years from now is not going to be available. We're not going to have oil left. We're not going to have coal left. And it is the, you know, the energy of the future. And, you know, the whole history of the development of nuclear energy, they had a program in the 1950s which was called Atoms for Peace. And one of the main ideas of Atoms for Peace, for example, was how do you bring electricity? Here's a, you know, here's a map. This is Canada, right? Most, Canada. Africa. Yeah, I've just seen if you're paying attention. Yeah, right. That's my next story. No, so Africa. Most of Africa has no electricity. Now, in the United States, up until, and Canada, some places in Canada didn't have electricity until the 1950s or even later, like out in the West and in the farmlands and so forth. The United States did not have residential electricity till the end of the Roosevelt administration, 1945. So, I mean, all those projects to, you know, to build the water dams, hydroelectric power, and to you know, lay the wiring and to build the telephone poles that carried the wires. After Roosevelt died, all of it came to a halt. And Roosevelt's vision, which is another subject that we'll take up, was to bring electricity to the entire planet. And this was John F. Kennedy's vision also. And this is, like, if you can adopt personal political goals, I really want to see in my lifetime that electricity is brought to every continent, to every country, to every village, that no, you know, child born in this time period ever has to have to live a life where they can't read, they can't study, and so forth because they have no electricity. They die early deaths because the hospital doesn't have, they have no hospital or if it has no electricity and stuff like that. And this is something that I would ask all of you to be committed to in one way or the other. These are the kinds of economic projects which should drive the whole question of economy, not what the stock market figures are. So so back to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That was a good deal, and a lot of countries signed it. 181 countries signed it. And there's only a few which didn't sign it. Israel, India, Pakistan, and Cuba. And back in the 1990s, India and Pakistan both built nuclear bombs. Yes? Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. So now you have a situation where Iran, which signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Oh, one other thing. The last part of the the last part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was finally signed in 1995, endorsed a resolution that said the entire Middle East should be a nuclear-free zone. No nuclear weapons in the Middle East. All the countries of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. 181 countries.
All said that the Middle East should be...
No nuclear bombs.
What about Israel?
Exactly. Exactly. Israel created a secret nuclear bomb.
In Israel in the Middle East?
Mm-hmm.
So why are they...
Why are they allowed? Right.
They didn't sign.
They didn't sign. And so Iran is saying, wait a minute, we signed, and we're not, you know, we're not creating a nuclear bomb. We're building nuclear energy plants. So Condi Rice says, I hardly think a country with so much oil needs nuclear energy. And then she was in for a rude awakening because the other oil countries of the Gulf, like Oman and United Arab Emirates and even Kuwait, all signed a resolution. They are going to develop nuclear energy because everybody knows that the oil is not going to last forever. Right? The control of the oil is a plot. If you're thinking about your nation existing 50 or 100 years from now, you know that you can't only have oil as your only means of the economy. So, and one of the things that Iran has said has been, you know, if the United Nations agrees to implement this non-nuclear power weapon clause of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we will actually stop our enrichment program. But of course, you know, that's not gonna happen. But Lynn's point, LaRouche's point is, forget the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There's no way to enforce this. In an insecure world, no one is going to live by this because they realize that, especially once India, Pakistan, and Israel came out with nuclear bombs, the rest of the country says, look, nuclear weapons are here to stay. And then they look at George Bush giving a speech talking about the axis of evil and the various countries who feel threatened are also going to start moving in the direction of greater instability. So that's how do you get out of a mess like this? Right? What are we going to do? We've got to turn to history again to look at a situation where you have to say, is there a precedent to this? Is there what Plato and Socrates called a higher hypothesis, a solution that lies outside of this set of conflicts and dead-end arguments that we're stuck in right now? And that is called something from 1648, which is known as the Treaty of Westphalia. And the Treaty of Westphalia ended the religious war between Protestants and Catholics, which was really a bloody horror. And it had two really, really important things in it. One was the concept of, that they called the advantage of the other. That my country will make decisions based on the advantage of my neighbor. Because I know that if my neighbor can be prosperous and peaceful, if I can help them do that, I will be less threatened. And if every country is thinking in that way as the advantage of the other, you may say that's a dream world, but that actually did work. Because people like Henry Kissinger says, we're in the post-Westphalia system. The Treaty of Westphalia, there's a second aspect of it, which is, and they've thought of everything. This secret roundtable that Val's going to tell you about. I mean, they've been really planning for this world empire for a long time. They know history as better than we do, which is why we have to study history. If you want to, you know, if you want to be in a political movement that actually is a potent political movement, then you have to know what they know. And you have to know more than what they know, because they're using knowledge for an evil intent. So the second part of the Treaty of Westphalia is to basically not hold grudges, and that past abuses will be forgotten. We're not going to go back and fight the same fight over and over and over and over again. There's no more blood feuds. Right? You know, in the Greek tragedies, at one point, there was this idea of how the pagan gods controlled things, that once you had a fate, you could inherit a fate. You know, if your father did something evil, then when you were born, you would be cursed. The revenge against him would come on you, and there was nothing you could do about it. Right? It was completely predetermined. And the Treaty of Westphalia was the end of blood feuds. No longer could you know, some royal family come into power and said, 2 centuries ago, you know, your family ruled the neighboring kingdom and killed my brother, and therefore we're at war again. So it was, you know, an agreement to a clean slate. Why? Because for 30 years, the most brutal meat grinder had gone on, and it was unbearable. So that Treaty of Westphalia today is what has to be applied inside Iraq. Is there any other way to balance the slate between the Sunnis and the Shiites at this point, in terms of even what's happened in the last couple of years? And I know there's a lot of misreporting among who's responsible for what. There's a lot of lies. There's U.S., Israeli, British hit teams. There's mercenaries out there who are out there killing people and blaming one another party to keep the fighting going on. Right? But there is no other way than the principles of Westphalia to get out of this situation. But is George Bush and Condi Rice and Dick Cheney capable of something like that? What's going on in the U.S. Senate, where ever since January 4th, there has been an investigative hearing every single day into how badly the Iraq war is being done. Every day there is a hearing and an investigation by the U.S. Senate into the conduct of this war. So, you know, we're really, and our movement is helping to steer that whole process into the direction of the impeachment of those responsible for this illegal war, the vice president and the president. So, you know, we are making progress, but we're in a race against time. Sunday, I think, is the 11th, right? Mm-hmm. The deadline. I don't know if they're going to give an extension or their...
Is this public knowledge to everybody?
Yes.
Secretary of Defense went on TV, I think it was a few days ago, saying that without regulating the situation in Iraq, they'd be hard-pressed to go into Iraq. Do you believe what he said?
No. He's right, and that's what his generals is telling him. His generals are saying, we can't go into Iran. That's why they're going to use air war. That's exactly why they're going to use air war, because they know they can't go. They don't have the troops.
Is that why they assembled 2 aircraft carriers in the Gulf?
Exactly. Right, 2 not just carriers, but what they call carrier groups. which might be as many as like 10 different types of ships, plus submarines.
Actually, one of the frigates that's in the second group is a Canadian frigate.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think about the implications there if things flare up. I mean, we've got 900,000 Muslims in Canada. Right? The implications and the fact we're also in Afghanistan.
No, good point. There's a little tiny article. I think it's only one page.
Mm-hmm.
2 pages, yeah.
What's the? I'm not clear on what the dates for.
Why the date?
What's the deadline for?
The deadline is the United Nations Security Council voted to tell you to shut down your nuclear research facility. We've been very patient with you, and we now, on February the 11th, if you don't listen to us, we're going to have to take action. They're not specific. It's not like they're saying we're going to start bombing you on that day. But that's the deadline. They say you have to shut down the nuclear research or else.
Who is you?
Iran.
Okay. That's right. And you know they're going to, okay, bring out the bombs.
Well, maybe they'll give it a few more days. But the point is it can, you know, with that type of language, if that type of threat's constantly there, it could happen at any time. So we've got to change the policy. We also have in the United States, there's five laws that have been introduced by congressmen who are very close to our movement, which says it is illegal to go to war against Iran unless they attack the United States.
Where's that coming from?
It's coming from the congressmen who want to stop Cheney from going to war. So they're telling the president, you are not authorized to go to war. But it takes a long time to vote and argue and so forth. So LaRouche's point is when you put in a bill like that, you better say the consequences is the House of Representatives will move to impeach you. Yes?
Iran's going to retaliate with nuclear weapons? Ils vont répondre avec des armes?
Si, ils répondent avec des armes, mais les autres pays vont répondre avec des armes.
Okay, what's the logic since to attack Iran, since Iran could, you know, retaliate?
Non,
Okay.
Why would Iran risk an offensive when every other country would just jump on an offensive? It's not smart from Iran's part to want to go and aggress another country.
Okay. Iran is not aggressing. It isn't attacking another country. Iran is not attacking anybody. What they are doing is...
retaliating?
No, they're just trying to build an energy plant. Right, with their own fuel source, right, you see? And the United States has declared this an act of war. Now, I mean, I could be, you know, I'm being a little bit general about this because, in fact, you have a complicated situation in Iraq which has spilled over into Iran because of the religious differences. So the, you know, the faction of, or the denomination of Islam that is one side in Iraq is the same type of Islam. It's called Shiism. Is the same type of Islam that is in Iran. So there's close relations religiously, etc. And through a whole complex of reasons, the current government of Iraq used to live in Iran during the period of time of Saddam Hussein.
Now,
So. Well, they were in exile. They weren't. That wasn't their. That was just their temporary home. Yeah. Question.
When you say or put the Iran in the context of not aggressing anybody, realistically, when they're making routine claims demanding Israel's destruction, promising to do that if they have the capacity to do it, calling for it all the time, participating in Holocaust denial, holding conferences on the denial of the Holocaust, what terms other than aggression could you put that in?
Political insanity. It is. It's political insanity. And I think Ahmadinejad's a nutcase.
But you don't think that that's aggression?
No.
And you don't
not under the well, let me ask you this. You think that is aggression for a preemptive military attack under the rules of international law?
If there was a clear and present danger of the development and deployment of a nuclear weapon system? Yeah, absolutely.
Are we there yet?
In Iran? I don't know. I'm not there.
Yeah, but that's... Are we there February 11th? I don't think so. I'm willing to take that risk.
Why?
And you, you know, but I just want to make very clear.
My follow-up question would be, why then is Iran not aiming, instead of just refusing to deal with the Security Council and their demands, politicking, I guess, appropriately, the United Nations, making a case for transparency, and this is our program and foreign inspections?
Oh, they are. Oh, they are. I spoke directly to the office of the International Atomic Energy Agency many times. To their press office. I read their press releases. They're on my Google Alert. They send it to me every single day. I know where Larijani is. I know where Mr. Saidi from the National Security Council of Iran is. Larijani is going to Munich to the International Conference of... it's called the Verkunde. It's the International Security Conference, which takes place every year. And he's going to be meeting with Solana from the European Union. He's going to be meeting with Al-Baradei from the IAEA. And Larijani, he's not as famous as Ahmadinejad because, you know, he gets all of the publicity. And he's a nutcase. And I look forward to the day when, you know, he is removed as president of Iran. And in the last election, you might not know this, but his party got smashed. Did you know that? Yeah? Okay, is that progress?
Still in power.
Is he in power? Is his power been limited?
I don't know if I have complete confidence in the democratic system of Iran. If you want to say that you don't have complete confidence in the democratic system in the United States, that's equally fair. I don't think that we should put blinders on just because that's the case in the United States.
I'm not blind, but you know, you said why aren't they politicking? I mean, this is, you know, this is serious, and I have the answers to this because, you know, I'm not taking sides in it. We're not playing around when it comes to, you know, to nuclear war. I know how dangerous it is. And when you ask how come they're not politicking to try and negotiate, I'm not saying they're not been stubborn. I thought the Russian deal that they were offered should have been taken.
What was the Russian deal?
The Russian deal is you suspend your uranium enrichment, and we will, you know, we will build your first nuclear reactor, which is called Bushehr, which is about to come online, and then we'll negotiate the rest. I think that's a perfectly reasonable deal. They haven't taken it, but I don't think that we dare go to war and use air power and use nuclear weapons against them, which is the U.S. doctrine, on the basis of Ahmadinejad's insane statements. And if there's a, you know, this Verkunde meeting is very, very important. The fact that, you know, John Kerry wants to go to Iran, trying to go to Iran. The fact that there's a dialogue caucus inside the U.S. Congress of Republicans and and Democrats to exchange congressmen with Iran. These are all alternatives to the war. And there's a point where you can't use the rhetoric, no matter how ugly it is. And I also have Israeli contacts who totally are against a preemptive strike against Iran. One of them, Shlomo Ben-Ami, was interviewed in EIR. You can read it from one of the back issues. There are dozens and dozens of leading Israelis, including military people, who are against this war. So the issue is, do we have an alternative to the preemptive military attack?
Michelle?
Yes.
Yeah. I just have a question on I'm not too sure if there was Iran open to inspection of the development sites and the enrichment sites?
Yes and no. I mean, it's a long history.
Is a possible no the reason why the UN Security Council all voted for the deadline, the February 11th deadline, and then we take action?
The February 11th deadline isn't exactly in the vote. It's supposed to be a period of review. And the head of the IAEA, Dr. Al-Baradei, has basically begged the United States to please cut out the rhetoric and give us a chance. I mean, because there's a couple of other things. What about the 3 years that Iran had suspended its nuclear enrichment tests?
Well, why won't they allow inspection,
No, they are. They limited some of the inspections because they're alleging that the inspections were... the information with the inspections was being used in a way, because this is all very secure, right? I mean, if you come into the United States or any other facility and you look at all of their secrets, and then that information is getting into the public record or to other intelligence agencies, and this is also part of the agreement about the IAEA, that confidentiality is supposed to be guaranteed. So Iran is claiming that the information was leaked out. So they've restricted some of it. It's not that they are not allowing inspections. They have limited certain access to the thing. And yet everybody, like even people here, all you hear on the news is the fact that they have kicked out the inspectors. But this is what we heard about Iraq also. And it wasn't true. It wasn't true. In 2003, it was not true when the UN inspectors were there. They were going to every single...
Hans Blix.
Yes, Hans Blix and Baradei. I spoke to the French Major General who was responsible for the destroying of rockets in Iraq. And they found a rocket which went 20 kilometers longer than was allowed. So they said, violation of the arms control thing. And so everybody expected, okay, the U.S. was going to move then. Does anybody know what happened to those rockets?
Did Saddam destroy them?
No, the UN destroyed them. And when I say destroy them, this lady gave me a half-hour interview where she told me not only did we destroy the rockets that we found, and when I say we destroy, and she was an expert in Soviet disarmament. So first they dismantle all of the bomb mechanisms. Then they take the, the metal components, and they have these huge crushing machines, which crush them and make them into pancakes, crepes, as she said. And then they take the crushed metal and they bury it in concrete.
Oh my God.
Right? And then they go to the machine tool stamping plant and they destroy those machines and they do the same thing.
Really?
And then they knew that the... I mean, I feel like a trivia idiot, but I mean, I interviewed the lady. and then they went to, because they knew that the rockets were deployed in different places, right? They knew they hadn't found all of them. And this was before the invasion began. And the Iraqi military said, obviously, well, look, they're, you know, we can't just move them out because they're in position, they're in our military positions. They're in our forward defense positions. So we're not going to move them out. So the arrangement was made that they would be moved at night so that they could not be, you know, watched by the ordinary surveillance methods. And they brought more of them, and they made more rocket crypts, you know. And so, I mean, this all happened, unfortunately, 6 days before the U.S. strikes began. So I can't answer every question. I have not interviewed the people who do the Iran inspections to the degree as Iraq. But I know, Val, the amount of propaganda that was going on about Iraq, and I'm skeptical. I think everybody should be skeptical. Yes?
Yeah, but since the president of Iran doesn't sound any wiser than Bush, I would be surprised that their nuclear research are for civil purpose only.
Well, you know, this whole thing started before he was the president of Iran. So, you know, there's an argument sophists use, I think it's called post hoc ergo propter hoc. You know, it is after the fact, therefore it always was before also. So when, huh?
What does that mean?
So, you know, just because you have Ahmadinejad now, that means when the Iranians started their program 5 years before he became the president and made these statements, therefore they, you know, when the United States was demanding that they stop the nuclear program, that the reason why the United States was probably demanding that they stopped it because they knew Ahmadinejad was going to come and threaten Israel. Right? So, you know, you can't start from now and explain everything which happened from, you know, from that standpoint. Now, let me just walk you through it one more time, okay? Ahmadinejad, do you know when he was elected?
2 years ago.
A little less, yeah. Right. And do you know who the president was before? Khatami. Right? Khatami never made any of those types of statements at all. And yet when Khatami was president was when the demand to cease the nuclear program was made. And they did cease it. And they asked for normalizing relations with the United States. Now, I'm not saying don't be suspicious. Don't be skeptical. But the issue is to open up, and this was the Baker-Hamilton recommendation, and my Israeli friend's recommendation. Open up a dialogue with Iran, because if you don't have talks, it can only get worse. Are you willing to give it that chance, or are you ready to go for a preemptive strike? Right, you said you're not sure. I mean, there's no turn.
The more you talk, the more continual nuclear preparation will go on, if that is what's going on.
Pardon me?
If talking is a delaying tactic on the Iranian part, then to develop a weapons program. really helping things or hurting things by continuing to talk.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And I mean, also another point is that the president of Iran doesn't have the same authority as the president of the United States. In other words, they don't control the military.
Which military?
Of their own country. The president doesn't, is not the commander-in-chief.
Well, that's usual.
In the United States, the commander-in-chief controls the military. Okay. The president controls the military.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Hmm. So
he gives the order, etc. In Iran, that's not the case. Yeah.
We assume that, like, because the soft approach of Qatar didn't work, didn't allow Iran to go ahead and develop nuclear power, nuclear enrichment. Is that why they take a harder stand now to assert themselves as a sovereign nation?
I think so. It's also an issue in third world countries. Brazil. If the United States wanted to make an issue with Brazil, we could be in the same position with Brazil, because Brazil said, forget it. We're not going to buy enriched uranium from somebody else. We're going to develop our own. We have the scientists. We have the know-how. We need it. We're not going to be sovereign if we don't have our own, if we can't use our own scientific knowledge, we're not sovereign. So we're not going to make a deal.
Is Brazil signatory to the NPT?
Yes.
Iran as well?
Yes. And Iran's threatening.
So theoretically they have the right.
That's right.
And actually, they have the de facto right. I mean, just by the fact that they're their own country.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. But if you have a situation where the other countries who signed on to it say, no, this is the agreement to it, but, you know, your rhetoric is no good, therefore, you're not allowed. That's really what's going on. And it's a very dangerous situation because, you know, there's a whole faction in Israel which says we've got to go for peace. Look what happened in Lebanon. You know, there's one Israeli who doesn't agree with going for peace. He said, hey, Moshe Dayan said we have to be seen as mad dogs. General Moshe Dayan. We have to be seen as mad dogs. And therefore, when we went into Lebanon and 1,000 civilians, including, you know, little children and buses and so forth, got killed, you know, maybe they learned a lesson. And if, you know, if that's not enough of a mad dog, maybe we have to kill 5,000 civilians. You know, there is a faction which says that.
What did they want to prove by doing?
Well, they had a group called the Hezbollah that had kidnapped an Israeli soldier. On the border there's incidents all the time. And in order to free the soldiers, they began a bombing campaign against Lebanon. And in the course of that, they killed many, many civilians until a ceasefire was reached. And this happened this past July. And some people who wanted the Israelis to attack Syria as well. And the argument that was just mentioned about, well, if the Iranians are just using that as stalling time for talks, I mean, that's a legitimate concern. I hear that argument made by the White House every day. Do they know it's a stalling mechanism? No, but it's that big if, which is so good for sophistry, right? If you say if in the hypothetical, you can just keep the argument going and never reach a solution. If it's only a stalling mechanism. So, but I have to tell you something. What we got to realize, and I want to get on to something else strategically. The Iran-Iraq thing is a sideshow. It's a mess, it's a quagmire, but this is not the main agenda. Right, what the really main agenda is that the this one world government faction is really aiming to crush Russia and China. And this is what we have to really orient to right now. Both of those are big-time nuclear powers. If the United States uses a nuclear weapon against Iran or any other country, preemptively, it's not going to stop there. It will escalate to a bigger nuclear war. When the United States dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was no other nuclear bombs existed in the world. But now, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of weapons for strikes and counter-strikes. This is what we have to worry about.
Aren't China and Russia in alliance with Iran?
Aren't they?
Aren't they backing, aren't they in an alliance with Iran through the Shanghai?
Iran is an observer to Shanghai Group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but they're not at war with Iran the way the U.S. has been.
No, I thought they were in alliance with Iran. That they would back Iran if U.S. were to attack.
I wouldn't be so sure. I think they would stay out of it. But it would escalate anyway. In other words, if the U.S. did that, I mean, Russia is not going to counterattack the United States because the United States attacks Iran. No. But it will get out of control.
Yeah. I've heard Mr. LaRouche obviously say many times that if we have this conflict in Iran,
mm-hmm.
Then it's going to lead to a world war. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the first time that I see him really putting the links or drawing out the picture that the intention is to go attack or involve Russia and China into a war.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something new or is that...
No, he's been saying this for a long time, but not emphasizing it in the same way because until this strategic development with the satellites, it was not as visible a strategic issue, you know, as it is now. Because, again, what China did was a significant military blow to U.S. capabilities, to this shock and awe air war capability. Because if you knock out the guidance system, you know, that's really significant. So what's happened is the as China, with this act, has thrown off the strategic equation. And so what Lynn is saying right now is to get the world off of a course of, you know, further wars, you really have to return to the U.S., China, Russia and India working together, because these are the largest economic powers, military powers, and population centers of the world. Get them working together to come up with a plan to really save the planet and to turn their energies to peaceful means, which includes removing the threat of war in the small, which is really, in these times, there's just not a way to contain it. This is what the military and the patriotic opponents to the Iraq war said. If you go into Iraq, it's going to spread. And, one of the senators gave a very, very powerful speech when they voted up the resolution in committee. He said, this was another hearing. Iran, the government didn't fall apart. We broke it. And there's a pamphlet that people can read about in the first 6 months of the occupation. There was an agreement made with the military of Iraq, minus all of the loyalists to Saddam Hussein, that they would keep the military intact, the military units, etc., and they would help to defend the country against Iran or Syria or anybody else. They would fight in cooperation with the United States. And they would maintain order of, the military. This was agreed to by the first person in charge of the occupation, Jay Garner, and then it was overturned and turned into what we call Halliburton's War. Right? Halliburton's War is the war of the private contractors that is, going on now. All right, so let me get on to this issue of, I'll tell you what, people really, really want to stay on the Middle East because it's so colorful and so, hot and so forth, and they don't want to look at the implications of what this China thing is. China has, I don't know the figures, but they have thousands of nuclear missiles that can hit the United States and Canada and Russia and India, and they're a formidable power. I mean, if everybody used all their nuclear weapons, the United States might get in the last shot. That's all I can say about it. But there wouldn't be much of the planet worth living in if that were to happen. So what I want to go back to is how LaRouche's role, LaRouche played a really, really critical role in the strategic situation in the 1980s, which actually led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union without war. It could have been a lot better, and we're now in the type of situation where, again, the proposal for war avoidance that LaRouche made at the time is what's on the table. So I'd like another. I want to actually show you a couple of slides first. Where's that?
What do you need? It's already there.
I want to change it. So, let me find the right place.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So.
Jeez. Theatric effect.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Oh, Screen went blank.
Maybe you get a...
Okay. In the meantime, Megan, would you do me a favor and read something?
Maybe
sure.
Just
read
F5.
Read.
F5?
Shift
F5.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we were at a point like this earlier in the early 1980s. When the Soviet Union was kind of militarily at its peak. And, you know, the world was kind of in a mess in the early 1980s. You had the Arab-Israeli war about to hook up again. Okay, good. And you had a new doctrine that had come into being. All right, let me see if I can get this. This new doctrine was the use of tactical nuclear weapons in the battlefields of Europe. So NATO, the idea was if there was an invasion by the Soviet Union, then, and vice versa, if the NATO forces were to invade Russia, either side would now move to tactical nuclear weapons. And I'm going to spare you this. But this is one little section of Hiroshima. One bomb. City of, I think, 200,000 to 300,000 people. That's a victim of a nuclear strike. So LaRouche was about 23 years old when that occurred. He was in the military in India. He was in the U.S. Army, and President Roosevelt had just died, and the soldiers were very worried that the next stage of World War II would be that the British would ask the United States to use the military to suppress the Indian Revolution in that area of the world. This is what the young soldiers were, they were really, really concerned about, is that they would be used as an occupying force for the British in India.
After
World War
II. Hiroshima?
No, this was just before Hiroshima.
Okay.
What
was the Indian whatever it was?
Pardon me?
What was the Indian revolution or whatever
it was? Did you ever hear of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the father of the Indian Revolution. Before that, India was a colony of the British. They didn't have their own government. You know, they were very, very, very oppressed. And they wanted to be independent. And so the British didn't want to give them their independence. And the rumor was that the United States military would be used with the British to prevent a revolution from happening. So that's what they were thinking when Roosevelt died. And then what happened was the nuclear bomb was dropped on Japan. And, I would say that Lyndon LaRouche's real commitment to finding a way to abolish the threat of nuclear destruction probably really, really became part of him during that experience in World War II. He was one of 16 million Americans who, you know, went in uniform to fight against the Nazis and the Japanese and so forth. And, you know, he was very, very strong about that. So in the late 1970s, when the idea was there that they would now use tactical nuclear weapons, that means that, you know, this could escalate very, very quickly. What if some general decides, okay, my army is going to get crushed. The only thing left that I can have to stop this horde coming in is a nuke, which is going to destroy not only the incoming army, but all the surrounding countryside. I mean, you saw the picture. That's an authentic picture of Hiroshima. So LaRouche spent a really, really long part of his life as an economist, first of all, seeing that nuclear power is the only path for the future, including what we really want to get to is fusion power. Right? Not fission, but fusion. And it runs on deuterium, which is from seawater. And then that was one idea, that we would have nuclear energy, fusion power to do the kind of good that I was talking about in terms of lighting up Africa, the world, etc. And secondly, he was totally committed to finding a way to stop nuclear war. And disarmament is never gonna work. You're always gonna find somebody saying, I'm not giving up my weapons, like an Ahmadinejad. Somebody like that is gonna appear. So you have to find another way to do it. And what LaRouche actually came up with in the course of working with the best physicists in the world for the purposes of trying to get a crash program for fusion power was to become informed about another technology, which were directed energy lasers, and the possibility that these lasers could be used to demobilize and render impotent incoming nuclear bombs. And we put out our first pamphlet on this in July 1977. LaRouche commissioned the first ever mass circulation report to the American people. And the title of it was called Sputnik of the 70s, emphasizing the fact that the technologies on the horizon for anti-missile defense were not weapons as such, were not other missiles, but were new physical principles of plasmas and lasers that could do this. And we distributed thousands and thousands and thousands of these pamphlets. And it was part of a campaign. In August 1979, a year before the election, where Ronald Reagan, who's on the right, seated on the right there, Lyndon LaRouche is on the left. So about a year before Reagan was elected, LaRouche, through his representatives, held the first discussions with Reagan, campaign people, on this energy beam defense. And then in December 1981, after Reagan was elected, the Reagan administration, through intelligence agencies, requested that LaRouche attempt to carry out back-channel discussions with Soviet representatives about new scientific and military strategies, and ask the Soviets, well, how would you react if the United States developed these laser systems, defense systems, on new physical principles that could stop nuclear war? Would you accept it? Would you? And LaRouche's proposal was that these two great powers that between them had the greatest arsenal of scientists, you know, really probably in all the rest of the world combined, that they worked together on this. Now that may sound crazy, but the point is that they were allies during World War II. You know, Uncle Joe Stalin, right? The guy who became like the most dangerous dictator in the world after that, and known as the most dangerous dictator, was the closest ally of the United States. You see picture after picture after picture with three guys, right? Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt. Because they were the three commanders of the anti-Nazi forces. So it wasn't so impossible for a veteran of World War II to say, we did it before, we can do it again. And after years of organizing, even after the response came back from the Russians, and they said, no, we're not going to accept it. We are not going to accept it. We don't want it to exist, number one. Number two, we are afraid that if you go and develop this new system, what's going to happen is that you're going to become so much economically stronger than us. They had seen what had happened to the American economy with the moon landing. Through the research and development and the commitment of the moonshot, right, the United States economy just took off like never before. So many incredible inventions, from, you know, food to building materials to communications and you know, everything we know that's involved in, you know, the internet and things like that began in the Apollo project. So the Russians said, no, we're not going there. We know that our economy sucks, and if you go ahead with this program, you're going to end up on top. That's the second reason. And the third reason we're not going to do this is because our friends, including Henry Kissinger, tell us that this isn't going to happen. Reagan's not going to go with this policy. And in fact, it almost didn't happen. And the speech was written. Reagan actually says, on my desk was a draft of the speech on defense to be delivered tomorrow night on TV. This one was hassled over by the National Security Council, State and Defense. Yesterday was a day that shouldn't have happened. But finally, I had a crack at it. March 23rd, this is Reagan's memoirs, his diary. March 23rd, the day he gave the speech. The big thing today was the 8 p.m. TV speech on all the networks about national security. We've been working on that speech for about 72 hours, right down to the deadline. I did the bulk of the speech on why our arms buildup was necessary, and then finished with a call to the science community to join me in research starting now to develop defensive weapons that would render nuclear missiles obsolete. I made no optimistic forecasts, said it might take 20 years, but we had to do it. I felt good. And so I want you to hear, Birgit told me that the speech might actually be on this tape, but I don't have a player, and we're not sure if it's really on there, but we'll check. If it's on there, we can see it tomorrow. It's only like 7 minutes or something. We'll do our background work. So, but in the meantime, we'll have Megan play Ronald Reagan in recent months. I'm right at the top.
Oh. In recent months, my advisors have underscored the necessity to break out of a future that relies solely on offensive retaliation for our security. Over the course of these discussions, I have become more and more deeply convicted that the human spirit must be capable of rising above dealing with other nations and human beings by threatening their existence. Wouldn't it be better to save lives than to avenge them? Are we not capable of demonstrating our peaceful intentions by applying all our abilities and our ingenuity to achieving a truly lasting stability? I think we are. Indeed, we must. After careful consultation with my advisors, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I believe there is a way. Let me share with you a vision of the future which offers hope. It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive. Let us turn to the very strengths and technology that spawned our great industrial base. The quote ends here. Do you want me to?
Let me see. Mm. I think it's a misprint, but
okay.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reach our own soil or that of our allies? Isn't it worth every investment necessary to free the world from the threat of nuclear war? We know it is. I clearly recognize that defensive systems have limitations and raise certain problems and ambiguities. If paired with offensive systems, they can be viewed as fostering an aggressive policy, and no one wants that. But with these considerations firmly in mind, I call upon the scientific community in our country, those who gave us nuclear weapons, to turn their great talents now to the cause of mankind and world peace, to give us the means of rendering these nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. We seek neither military superiority nor political advantage. Our only purpose, one all people share, is to search for ways to reduce the danger of nuclear war. My fellow Americans, tonight we are launching an effort that holds the promise of changing the course of human history. There will be risks, and results take time, but I believe we can do it. As we cross this threshold, I ask for your prayers and your support.
If you'll just go a little bit further, in the next page is a telegram or message that LaRouche sent to Reagan the next day.
No longer.
Okay.
No longer must Democrats go to bed each night fearing that they must live out their lives under the threat of thermonuclear ballistic terror. The coming several...
Now this, I'm sorry, this is now LaRouche speaking in a letter, in a response to Reagan, who he's been in this back channel discussion, and the way it worked was the people at Reagan's National Security Council would meet with LaRouche, and LaRouche would tell them the discussions that he had had with these Soviet diplomats. And then they would get a reaction, and then LaRouche would have another discussion with the Soviets to say, well, have you considered the benefits of this or that, how we could work together? And this dialogue went on actually for about a year and a half, I think. So this is what LaRouche finally said after Reagan, you know, adopted the policy.
No longer must Democrats go to bed each night fearing that they must live out their lives under the threat of thermonuclear ballistic terror. The coming several years will be probably the most difficult of the entire post-war period, but for the first time since the end of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, there is at last hope that the thermonuclear nightmare will be ended during the remainder of this decade. Only high-level officials of government or a private citizen as intimately knowledgeable of details of the international political and strategic situation as I am privileged to be can even begin to foresee the earth-shaking impact the pre- president's television address last night will have throughout the world. No one can foresee what the exact consequences of the president's actions will be. We cannot foresee how ferocious and stubborn resistance to the president's policy will be, both from Moscow and from the nuclear freeze advocates in Europe and the United States itself. Whatever those reactions and their influence, the words the president spoke last night can never be put back in the bottle. Most of the world will soon know and will never forget that policy announcement. With those words, the president has changed the course of modern history. Today, I am prouder to be an American than I have been since the first manned landing on the moon. For the first time in 20 years, a president of the United States has contributed a public action of great leadership to give a new basis for hope to humanity's future to an agonized and demoralized world. True greatness in an American president touched President Ronald Reagan last night. It is a moment of greatness never to be forgotten.
Now, at the time, LaRouche was actually running a two-track policy, two main tracks. One was on this military strategy that new physical processes, lasers, could be used to stop nuclear war, and that the research and the building of this thing would make such scientific breakthroughs that we could actually go into a new paradigm of economic development and prosperity, where we could accomplish the, you know, the kind of tasks that had been left unaccomplished, like the developing of countries out of colonialism. And at the center of LaRouche's policy was great projects, where you take different parts of the world and you conceptualize what kind of water projects, energy projects, transportation projects, and education would be needed for that country to bring their populations into the 20th century, into the 21st century, to stamp out disease and all of these things. And it kind of begins with this. This is a scene from the United Nations. The man in front was a leader of our organization after he left the government of Guyana. He was the foreign minister at one time. He was the justice minister at another time. He was one of the original core of revolutionaries in British Guyana, which is in South America, who actually were in the first generation of government. He also was a hilarious comedian, and he could quote many of Shakespeare's plays end to end by memory.
His name again?
Fred Wills, Dr. Frederick Wills. And he was a real avowed enemy of Henry Kissinger. What Dr. Wills is doing at this speech in 1976 is calling for a world debt moratorium by all of the countries that owe money to the International Monetary Fund, which would have been a total revolution. And that's how he and Henry Kissinger came to loggerheads at that point. Because Dr. Wills was really one of the first initiators of this idea, which then became discussed at many of the meetings of the non-aligned movement. It was something that Mrs. Indira Gandhi, the head of India, who I don't have a picture of, but who's somebody who met with Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche several times, also adopted. And the idea was that countries that had been lent money by the IMF could not pay, because the economies of the world were really not in in a position that favored poor people. So instead of grinding and squeezing out the payments from their own population by cutting wages and so forth, that they would take a time out on the debt. We'll pay you in 20 years. We need 20 years to develop our economy and so forth. One of the tricks that had been played is that when they borrowed the money, oil was like $7 a barrel. And in between the time they borrowed the money, this was one of the main factors, there had been the Middle East oil boycott by OPEC and so forth, and you had a situation where now oil went up to $30 a barrel. So, I mean, you know, they were like nowhere in terms of development under those situations. So, it was Mr. LaRouche who actually proposed to Dr. Wills, to the president of Mexico, López Portillo, who a few years later delivered a similar discussion. Now, what would the countries do with the money instead of paying it back to the IMF? These are some of the projects I want you to think about. This is a map of the South American water and rail projects. There's transcontinental highways. I believe those are the dotted lines. Rail routes, a proposal for the second Panama Canal, that's that tiny little blue line up in the isthmus there where it's mostly water on either side. A sea level canal, which the plan was already done by Japanese companies. And there's an interesting book which we reviewed for EIR, if anybody's interested. It's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Did anybody ever hear of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, by a guy called John Perkins. And he talks about how the Omar Torrijos, the president of Panama, was assassinated for contemplating such a thing like a new Panama Canal. So that's some of the projects. Let's see, what else? The gray areas are called the productive access zone between Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina, which is really, you know, very rich in minerals and farmland and water, etc. Okay, here's another illustration of where you have parallel river and canals and railroad projects along the two sides of Mexico. And if you think about what's required to do these projects and what are the benefits of them, well, you have all these places where these tiny little villages, people have no work, they scratch out subsistence agriculture and so forth. There's no future. You know, unless you leave the area through these development corridors, you actually have a situation where towns can develop, commerce can develop, somebody can open a factory. You're not going to open up a factory somewhere where there's no road to get what you produce out of there, right? It's not going to happen. It makes no economic sense at all. So you have to have a road or a railroad or some kind of corridor. And these aren't plans we just drew on a map, right? We talked to people who live there, engineers, government ministers, and so forth, and say, how do you get rid of poverty in Mexico? So, well, we had this plan, but it was never built. Why wasn't it built? Because the government didn't have any money. Well, why can't they go to the banks? Well, the banks won't lend it to them. So, you know, you have to have an economic system, which Lynn and Helga called the new just world economic system. How about if economic development was based on justice, not profit? Would we have more wars or fewer wars? Yeah. So these are the ideas, and people get very, very excited about this. Now, this is the the crux. Those red lines all represent rail lines, railroad, which is really the most efficient mass transit system that you can imagine. And this is called the Eurasian Land Bridge. In 1996, Helga Zepp-LaRouche, LaRouche's wife, went to Peking, China, Beijing, China, and participated in a whole week-long conference. The purple is China, of course. And see, China is another one of these British colonial areas where all of the development is on the coast. And the interior is very isolated, backward, etc. So how do you develop the interior? Helga was joined by many governors from the provinces of Western China, the purple-colored part, in which they talked about this 1,000 miles of railroad as a string, that along this there would be a string of pearls. And the string of pearls referred to each city. Each population center would be part of this string of pearls that could actually develop, the people of China. African rail development. The black lines are the existing rail lines. The red are the proposed rail lines. Now,
is that today or?
Today, well, 10 years ago. 9 or 10 years ago. It's probably the same today. You know, because things in Africa have actually gotten not so much better. It's gotten worse. You notice that the preponderance of existing railroad lines are in South Africa, which was white, where they had apartheid until, the 1990s. I guess it broke down in 1980, around 85, 86. And it's also an area wherever the black lines went interior, chances are they were linking up to different mining interests, right? Gold, uranium, titanium, just you name it. The types of rail lines which we've proposed are ones that actually link different economic geographic capabilities to one another for the purposes of actually expanding the agriculture, the food transportation, and all of these other things in this area. So, years and years of research went into constructing these maps, including our discussions with experts in the areas and experts, who've dedicated their lives to studying the areas. Water development. The blue lines are the proposed water projects. And, I'm sorry, I haven't looked at this one in a long time, so I can't I really can't go into this right now, but yeah.
What do you mean by water development?
Okay, for example, the line here, right, that leads to that depression, which would be a freshwater lake. That's a waterway which, pardon me? It doesn't exist right now. Right, it was a former river that dried the riverbed dried up, or something like that. But it could be built into a canal. Right, you've heard of the Erie Canal, people, right? That links the Great Lakes. That didn't exist, but it was obvious to somebody with an engineering perspective, like the Washington government or Alexander Hamilton and so forth, say, hey, if we connect these Great Lakes, do you realize you can actually sail a ship from, Europe, into the Great Lakes, and you can go all the way, much further and stuff like that? So that type of things, to be able to bring in raw materials for production, bring in raw materials for building, for food, for all types of things, and to set up industries which then can get out, is a tremendous advantage. So that's That's another version of the map I showed before, with only the existing rail. You see, all across.
Take the proposal into account, or what?
But it's not been implemented. These are still things which need to be done. Okay. Now, this construction project is, again, going back to history. This is Florence again. Right? Florence that we've been talking about in terms of the Black Death, which was utterly destroyed. And then Florence, which was then center of the Council of Florence, where they established this doctrine of man in the image of God, which began to get humanity out of the Dark Ages and into the Renaissance. One of the ways they did that was not just hypothetically, but they said, okay, we're going to build something which is in tribute to the higher existence of mankind, which is a cathedral. This is a church. And that happens to be the largest dome on a cathedral ever built. And it was completed in the middle of the 14th century, 600, it was going on 600 years ago. And it's still standing. So, that's an example of a great project where it took all of the skills of all of the engineers and workmen and so forth, and the actual designer of it, Brunelleschi, based it on the scientific principle called the catenary, which, if you've been to other classes, you've probably had classes on the catenary, right? No?
It's been a while.
Oh, okay. Well, then you don't know the secret of how that dome is standing. No, but it was that project which actually brought the world out of, out of the Dark Ages and rebuilt civilization. Now, I just want to go over one other aspect of this. Show you what a... an artist's rendition of this beam technology that we're talking about is. This is a drawing from the Pentagon. That's one version of it. This would be a space-based laser. So that machine is orbiting.
As we speak.
No, it's never been built. But the tracking mechanism, the guidance system, and so forth, and the electron beam is targeted at, the little white thing is an incoming missile, an ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile. And so what it can actually do is, in space, as these things are coming in, should a nuclear war ever start, these lasers can actually demobilize the nuclear reactor. Nuclear reaction, yeah.
Well, I'm just curious, did the Chinese shoot their satellite from the ground or from the space?
We think it was from the ground, but... And we think it was not with a laser. But laser guidance was probably involved. It could be possible that they have something like this, but we're still investigating. We don't think so.
Yeah, but they blinded it. They didn't disarm it.
No, it's two different things.
Well, yeah. Didn't they only blind it?
That was, they blinded a U.S. satellite in September. They shot down their own satellite on January 11th.
Okay. And so, shooting from space, though, what if you miss,
Then you don't hit anything.
So then you're screwed.
You don't hit anything. You mean what if nuclear war starts and you miss? Yeah, that's a bad deal.
No, what if you miss the missile? You know,
like,
could the laser
hit something else?
Would the laser?
Yeah, but it wouldn't destroy much.
The laser's gonna just burn it, or is it gonna incapacitate its circuits or whatever?
It's circuits, yeah.
Well, it's gonna fry the circuits so the thing can't detonate even if it hits the ground.
Yeah,
it'll still hit.
We don't know.
And that would be damaging enough, right?
No, it probably, it'll be part of the space garbage. There's a lot of space debris up there.
Okay, so this is start, it doesn't blow up.
They used a high energy beam that could detect, you could even disrupt or break up some of the welds. And I guess apparently these ICBMs are not made all that, they're not made to last in a sense, right? They're one use only, so.
Disposable.
Disposable?
Yeah, so I mean, if you could simply disrupt the metal or something like that, so when it's, because these things are very high altitude, and potentially they just burn up parts in the atmosphere.
Now we had, there's many questions. I mean, we could spend hours and hours and hours just, you know, on this. And we have, you know, we have a book called Beam Weapon Defense, which we wrote to answer all of these types of questions. We had a movie. When Reagan, this is a funny story, when Reagan announced this, you know, the reporters were like stunned. What is he talking about? They immediately called it Star Wars. And they started ridiculing it. I mean, cartoons galore came out of you know, Reagan as Darth Vader and all of these things. Yeah. And, I mean, there was a total campaign to kill this thing, to stop it. And the Soviets, when they rejected the back channel offer, they said, nope. And they went on a propaganda campaign to say that what Reagan was doing with this program was preparing a first strike, which is, we can use our nuclear weapons in the United States, and when you try to hit us back, we're going to use this type of thing to block you, and you don't have it. So that was the campaign, that this proposal was a proposal for World War III, and it actually never did get built. But now, the thing that's put it back on the agenda is the Chinese are using, they're working on something like this. Let me go through a couple of, hold your question, you know, hold that thought. We'll come back to it. I just want to finish a couple of other ideas. We had a different model, and the funny story I was going to say was the reporters called up some of the think tanks that were close to Reagan, like the Heritage Foundation, and said, we want to do an interview about this strategic defense initiative. And the people at Heritage said, call the Fusion Energy Foundation. This is their thing. And on March 24th, Paul Gallagher, on behalf, he's one of the founders of our organization, and he's a economics editor of EIR. So he was on CBS television, not Canadian Broadcasting, but the U.S. CBS, and he was interviewed on the evening news as the first non-governmental spokesperson for the Strategic Defense Initiative. And we even had a picture. Long before this picture was drawn by the Pentagon, we had a drawing of what the laser defense system would look like. And the idea that we had come up with is that you actually have a laser on the ground, and that the thing in space would be a mirror, a huge, gigantic mirror, like the type of optics used in telescopes, that would be perfectly guided and therefore was much easier to retarget because it could, you know, it could orbit and so forth. Very sophisticated guidance systems, and the ground-based laser would reflect off and into the incoming target. So there's many different, you know, ideas that could be done on this. But, I mean, there was really a campaign by the Soviets to crush this thing. There was a campaign by the Democrats to crush this thing. And it was all based on the fiction of the danger of nuclear energy, which I think all of you are brainwashed against to a little bit, even if you think that, you know, okay, maybe there is some merit to nuclear energy. All of you and the boomers, too, have been either put through a kind of anti-nuclear idea to the point that you could really, really say, countries shouldn't do that. You know, they should, it's dangerous. You don't know why it's dangerous. The first really danger story that came up was a movie, a fiction called The China Syndrome. It made Jane Fonda famous and so forth, but it didn't really happen.
Don't we know the...
Let me finish this part of the thing and then we can have a couple questions. So I want to link it back to the technology issue, right? Because you don't always think about the benefits of something like this. See, these types of particle beam lasers and so forth, this involves the capturing of energy in ways which mankind still does not understand. Like with the fusion power. If they've done it, they know they can fuse to atoms. And you get a tremendous burst of energy. And they know that there's another state of matter called a plasma, which is not a gas, a liquid, or a solid. Right? It's a plasma which has a lot of tremendous energy potential in it if it can be harnessed. So much so that when Princeton University in the U.S. The machine that they had, it was called a tokamak, it was, I think, of Russian design. It has to be magnetically confined, this plasma. So they know that fusion power is possible, but right now it takes more energy to put into it than it takes to get out of it. Now, here's a paradox. We've also proven it takes more energy into ethanol then you get at it. How come we're developing ethanol and not fusion power? Right?
Because Bush is in front of the presidency.
Yeah, that's part of it. And a lot of other friends who really want to contain technology, keep it more contained. So the idea of the amount of research that it would take to develop and perfect these systems could have a tremendous benefit for human knowledge and for human development. And that's the direction that we want to go to. So, I think I'm going to stop there, perhaps with just one more thought from LaRouche, who is now really reviving this issue, because this is the, the way that we have to go to get the economic development and so forth. So, all right, getting back to this idea that what we're really up against is a design to destroy sovereign nation states. Iraq can be destroyed, Somalia can be destroyed, Sudan, preemptive war, Iran's next on the chopping block. And for the superpowers, they shouldn't be really sovereign either, but they should all get together in these supranational bodies where you really rid yourself with such old-fashioned encumbrances such as governments of the people, by the people, and for the people, and that's not really practical. So let the wise oligarchs rule. So that's really people who talk about the end of the Westphalia system, like Kissinger's theory and so forth. So LaRouche said in one article where he said the strategic necessity to revive this SDI concept. He said, thus, to dissolve the sovereignty of the nation state is to bring on a descent into barbarism. Such has always been and will always be the case. It is for the cultivated state of affairs among the sovereign nations of mankind, and that alone, that we are allowed and sometimes compelled not only to make, but to win war, when war was necessary, but to do that with nothing but that exit strategy in view. In other words, when you go to war, you must, it is a moral requirement that you must have in mind an exit strategy in which you leave the place. You go to war because you must go to war, because conditions are so horrible that humanity cannot survive with it. But you are required to go to war with an idea that with that exit strategy, you leave that place better than it was and the best that you can possibly do. And then LaRouche concludes that on that account, strategic ballistic missile defense, as I defined it, as President Reagan proposed on March 23, 1983, is essentially nothing differing from the most natural expression of a properly cultivated moral way of life. The proper motive for all important policies is not limited to a specific calculable outcome. The proper motive for every policy, for action, is to affirm constantly, continuously being a person and part of a society acting in accord with the special moral nature of a member of the human species. So that's what strategy is. That's the type of outlook that we have to, that we are fighting for in the Congress of the United States. And it involves walking in the footsteps of, you know, some of the best thinkers and collaborators like Dr. Wills, who's passed away, President López Portillo, who was the president of Mexico, who implemented partially a part of Operation Juarez to gain control of his country's banks. And I want to show you some of the recent events. This is 2004. The lady in yellow is Helga LaRouche. She's speaking in Rhodes at a conference on the dialogue of cultures, the dialogue of civilizations, where you had Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, Islam, Muslims, etc., discussing the merits of all of their different contributions of each culture has made that can actually bring about peaceful cooperation. Here you have Mr. LaRouche in 2003 speaking at a conference in India at Calcutta University on the question of, you know, how you're going to develop. I mean, India is a place with 1 billion people, very poor. What are they going to do about that? How are they going to feed, clothe, employ all these people? On that same trip, Mr. LaRouche and his wife were received in a reception by the president, Narayanan. This is Lynn speaking in 2002 at the Zayed Center in Abu Dhabi. He's speaking on water development as the key to peace in the Middle East. Water, not oil. This is Mr. LaRouche in the center in Moscow, September 2003. It's the Academy of Sciences Institute of the Far East is talking about cooperative relationship between Russia and China. That's the land bridge. This is Lynn and Helga in Moscow, 1995, and that's where we began. So in each of these conferences, the issue has been to take these great projects, these great development projects, which, you know, many of us take for granted. Like, we take electricity for granted. But did you ever live through a blackout? Anybody ever been through a blackout?
1998.
Yeah, that was a nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, imagine
come
a blackout
on,
that doesn't
you're
end.
Not being able to keep a hot shower for the days or something.
Yeah, no, seriously. So everyone was freezing. It was the middle of January.
No, you take these things for granted, right? We take many, many, many things for granted, and you don't think about the axioms involved in really what gets you here. You turn on a light switch and the light comes on. You know, you go to the internet and, you know, you can play games, you can talk to your friends for much less money than making phone calls used to be. You can, you know, you can do all kinds of identities, you know. No, we take much too much for granted in this whole thing, and the time has come where, as Lynn said, in founding the youth movement, really the world belongs to you guys to fight for the future. Really, I'm a boomer. I'm a recovering boomer. I'll probably never recover. I'll probably be a boomer forever.
That was so foolish. Oh, my God.
No. I don't mean I'll have boomer qualities, but age-wise, I mean, you know, I was born after World War II, so that was it, you know, the time that there was a baby boom. No, but this is, you really have to think about these ideas and take these concepts into consideration. Why has electrification projects been written off the agenda? Right? Why are we not, you know, pursuing peaceful space technology? Why has classical music died except for what we were reviving? Why is the Lurish Youth Movement the first people in 400 years who actually ever took what Kepler wrote in The Harmonies of the World, in which he identifies that the harmonies of the intervals of the planets, which Megan will go through, correspond to the musical scale, the notes of the musical scale. And that website that she showed you actually go through the numbers and you can hear the tones, because one of our members in Europe, Jean-Sébastien, is a cellist who actually played the notes so you can hear the intervals and so forth. So these are the, you know, the questions that are before us that really can lead to a new renaissance. And, you know, now that this incident happened with the Chinese, it's kind of forcing the issue. So let's take what's happened here to bring about these policies that never got finished, that never got implemented. So, Val, question?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was just thinking that it could be good to investigate who were the ones that were initially launching the anti-nuclear campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you wanted to say something about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we did a whole investigation of that, and I mean, you know, the environmentalist movement was actually founded by two leading Nazis, Prince Bernhard of Holland, of the Netherlands, and Prince Philip, of the husband of the Queen of England. Now, why did they do this? Why would two princes married to two queens, I mean, real queens, not slang queens, you know, why would they found the World Wildlife Fund? Yeah.
And Julian Huxley, who was formerly the head of the Eugenics Society.
Yeah. Right. You can say more about that. No, look, the answer is in the idea of the oligarchy. Right? Oligarchy means the rule of a few by bloodline and so forth, and by inheritance. And the idea of the rule of the few is that the upper 5% of humanity should be what counts, and everybody else is, you know, more or less owned property. Right? Maybe you're not owned like slaves were owned, but owned property in the sense that you're second-rate citizens. And in his younger days, Prince Philip was famous for the quote in an interview, which he said, if I could have my wish, I would be reincarnated as a deadly virus. I would be reincarnated as a deadly virus so that I could reduce the population, because the human population is the biggest danger to the survival of the planet. So, so these were we tracked it all out. You know, there's groups, there are NGOs, right, which we were talking about earlier, non-governmental organizations that were set up to, quote unquote, save the environment and so forth.
What about the big oil companies?
Sure, the oil companies were part of it. See, the World Wildlife Fund started with an organization which was called the 1001 Club. The 1001 Club was 1001 of the wealthiest people in the world who were invited. They each had to contribute $10,000, and it included oil company execs, bankers, owners of mining, etc. You had a question back there? Okay. Yeah?
Can you touch briefly on the Westphalia?
Mm-hmm.
In Jerusalem, in the post Westphalian era. But I remember when I was in Washington and we had this mobilization when the Khatami was there,
mm-hmm.
the president of Iran. And we were talking with people that are studying law and everything, right? And we mentioned that to them. And they would say, oh, yeah, that's. There's a lot of deep path, great nation, very easy definition. And a lot of those people would miss the point, because when you hear someone like Kissinger or anyone else saying, okay, now it's the post was still in the era, we'll say, yeah, maybe, you know, we're in a new system. You know, there was 1648, not 2006. But if you can just elaborate a bit more on the principle behind that, in order to see what this exactly means.
Sure. Okay, so let's go back to the 30 Years' War, because first you got to understand what the Westphalia Treaty was and how difficult it was to bring it about. So the 30 Years' War was really more like the 80 Years' War. And if people, anybody here has read the Schiller play Don Carlos? Yeah, not too many. this is a really brilliant play about King Philip II of Spain and his son Carlos. And how at that time the people of Flanders wanted their independence. They didn't even want their independence. They just wanted to have a Flemish governor appointed, and they wanted to have the right to practice freedom of religion. Right? The Protestants had come into being and so forth. And the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, had come into being. And, people were put on trial. The burning at the stake, that was a very popular form of execution by the Inquisition and so forth. And that was like in 1568, 1570, and Flanders never got their independence as part of Holland until 1648. And so that was part of it, and that every single section of Europe was actually in a constant state of warfare. Even when they were not in religious war, they were in property wars, they were in succession wars, brothers would raise armies to kill the other brother or the cousin or something like that. And this is the nature of oligarchy and monarchy, right? And the more powerful would come and steal the territory and so forth. So part of the Treaty of Westphalia was, in fact, an affirmation of the borders of nations. That when a nation existed, the neighboring nation, or you know, the one 500 miles away, couldn't arbitrarily say, we're going to take you over, we do not respect your nation. So that somebody inside a nation would often make a claim to the throne, then make a deal with the king or queen somewhere else, or the emperor, to come and invade his country. And this went on for 30 years, an active war, and it went on for really 80, even 100 years. So when the Treaty of Westphalia was made, it was part of a number of treaties leading up to it. And the specifics aren't important. The principles are important. Any, you know, legal positivist who says, well, you know, I don't agree with the division of Munster and, you know, something or other, which you will get these kinds of academic discussions. The Treaty of Westphalia were not perfect. It wasn't. The details were not the important thing. The principle, and there was like, you know, 7 or 8 different paragraphs, and the only ones that I've really studied in details because they're so unique and they're so axiomatic is the advantage of the other and the burying of past revenge so that you can never reopen these old issues that kept coming back even though they were solved. Now, the people like Kissinger who want to destroy the nation state. Now, why do they want to destroy the nation state? It has to do with finances and who really controls the world. Because until there were nation states in which the sovereign, whether it's a president, which I think is the best form of government, I do think the Constitution of the United States is the best, as Leibniz would say, the best of all possible approaches.
No arguments.
Maybe the Mexican limb Constitution.
Well,
it has potential.
It has potential, right, untested potential. Right, so, but the idea of people like Kissinger and the spokesman against the nation state is until the nation state came into being, the only real power was wealth. Who owned the wealth would control all the, you know, all the decisions. This is the Venetian system that I was talking about, and the banking system which exists today, the system of banking that we live under today was actually invented by the Venetians. And this whole process of using indebtedness to literally take over a country was the way Venice, this little empire in the corner of a swamp in Europe, this is the way they were able to exert power over sovereigns. Venice didn't have a big army. It had the best intelligence service in the world. It had the best spy system. It played both sides against the middle. They were financing, Venice was financing the Crusades at the same time they were financing the Ottoman Empire, the Muslims, to fight the Crusaders and charging a commission on either end. So when nation states came along, they had the power to tax, to regulate, to put limitations on what financiers could do. Usury. Or throwing people in prison for owing money. No, you know, finally laws were made that said to the bank, you cannot throw people in prison, them and their family and their children and so forth, like the British system did, because they owe money. You don't have that right. And in fact, in the United States, they implemented a law which is called the bankruptcy law. It's been revised now. But the bankruptcy law was basically no person could be ruined to the extent that they could be imprisoned and their children put into prison to grow up like animals in a cage. Look, by the end of the 1700s, this got so bad that one of the British philosophers, or I don't know what you call him, Jeremy Bentham, he actually even designed a perfect debtor's prison, which was called the Panopticon. Panopticon, which meant you could see everything that was going on. And it was I think it was like in the shape of an octagon, and the jail person sat on a tower in the middle of this thing, and all the people in the prison lived. This is when, in the days of debtors' prisons, where whole families were imprisoned. And while they were in prison, they would be made to do prison labor, slave labor. So Bentham, he ascribed to something that was called utilitarianism, and he even devised machines where the children's playgrounds were all levers and seesaws and, you know, merry-go-rounds and so forth, where the children's play would actually power something.
Model of efficiency.
Exactly. So, you know, that's an example. That's not even an extreme example. Bentham was the chief philosopher of the British East India Company, one of the most powerful financial institutions. The British East India Company really was the basis of the British Empire. But nation states is really the only thing that could actually put a regulation or to stop the wild antics of financiers, short of actually having more power and more money to, you know, to crush what they were doing. So nice talking to you.
Yeah, very good presentation. I enjoyed it a lot.
Come back.
She gotta go far.
Okay. Yeah, so anyway, a sovereign country can make laws that tells to the bankers, you can't do this. Wealth isn't everything. We have such principles as the the general welfare. And this really is for the Kissinger Empire faction. They absolutely want to get rid of the nation state because it is an impediment to them being able to do whatever they want. Now, they've got something in the meantime. Free trade. Right? Free trade is a stupid agreement, and it basically tells every country, you don't have the power, we will have to punish you. We, the World Trade Organization, are going to have to punish you and put sanctions against you if you try and regulate business interests. So the free trade doctrine, globalization, is part of the plot to destroy the concept of nation states. So, that's just really, it's easy to look, it's easy to say, oh yeah, the Westphalian system, you know, it's over, it's up, because nobody knows what it is. Nobody can even give you an argument for the most part. Even people who have, you know, college degrees in history and so forth can't really tell you what the Treaty of Westphalia is about. So I think I said earlier today, we've got to know history at least as well as those who want to destroy the Republican system of government do. Actually, it would be safer to know better. Yeah, we'll come with you. Yeah, question?
I was just going to ask. So the system of usury,
mm-hmm.
money lending to individuals as well as countries as a whole, is what it's used by the oligarchy as a way of making serfs of people again, like a return to feudalism or something?
Sure. And it's, you know, a means of control. I mean, sometimes it's low interest rates that do it. You know, in the 1970s, the Federal Reserve interest rate was like 18% interest, 20% interest. And I'm not talking about, that's credit card interest, right? At least in the U.S. it is. Mm-hmm. One time, the current President Bush's father suggested that interest rates on credit cards should be capped at 14%. And the next day, like 30 bank stocks fell by 10%. He had to retract it immediately. Just the mere thought that, you know, that would happen. Because the credit card divisions were actually the most highly performing section of banks. But then on the other hand, you've had this phenomenon in the U.S. for the last really 9-10 years of easy money, easy credit, right? And what's that done is unlimited credit to people, such that if you actually put a lid at the on the availability of credit at this point, you would actually have, you know, maybe 30% home foreclosures. Something in that vicinity. I mean, really, really radical collapse of family incomes. One of the things that you'll read about in EIR is that for the year of 2006, the entire personal income of the entire United States of America, on average, worked at a 1% deficit, which means that people had to spend 1% more than their income. And then we looked further into this, and we have a report that this has been going on for 22 successive months. And that was in the London Times, so it must be true, right? No, but 22 successive months, and what that is actually, there hasn't been such a stretch of negative savings in that way since 1933. 1933 was the last year of the U.S. Depression that was not affected by Franklin Roosevelt's policies. He got inaugurated in March of 33, and in the next 3 months, let's see, April, May, June, by July, you already had the New Deal ideas coming in, the bank holiday, etc. So 1933 was the turnaround year, the beginning of the turnaround. But I mean, this is incredible, because there's you know, the upper 1-3% is so fantastically overpaid in the United States that for there to be an actual negative 1% savings rate for an entire year is alarming. And this was done, this indebtedness was done by easy credit papering over the real distress of the economy. Because people have been using borrowing on everything that they have to, because the credit is easy, to keep afloat.
Yeah. Yeah, people couldn't borrow this extra money to spend and what the economy was slowed down.
If they couldn't eat, they wouldn't be able to make the car payments, they couldn't get to work, they couldn't get, you know, buy the gasoline. They couldn't make the mortgage payments and so forth. I mean, people are living on hand to mouth, which is helped by the credit. And, you know, some of the middle class families, I mean, these are well-off people who, you know, between the husband and wife working, might be bringing in something like $150,000 a year, and they're in debt. And they're in debt $50,000 on top of all that money. This is a very, very common, you know, a common phenomenon in the U.S. Okay, I think a little informal discussion is probably good. Yeah, thank you very much.